I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome back to the Prospect Podcast. I'm Ellen Halliday, Deputy Editor at Prospect, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Dejan Sujic, author, broadcaster, and former director of the British Design Museum, who's been delving into the story of how a group of billionaires are planning to build a new city in Solano County, California. Today, we'll discuss what the city would look like, and what the idea of private equity-backed new cities tells us about whether capitalism has any answers to the crisis in affordable housing. Dejan, thank you so much for joining the podcast.
It's very good to be here.
So, first of all, Dejan, can you take us to this Californian city? Paint us a picture of the place it is as it is and what's imagined for there.
Solano County is about an hour and a half's drive from San Francisco, heading inland. At the moment, it's been designated as a slow growth area. It's farmland, quite dry, lots of hard scrabble farming folk who've been there for three generations, mainly sheep. There's a US Air Force Transport Command base, but at the moment it's waiting, ready, anxious, thinking about what the life might be like, that the fact that over the last 7 years, a group of, until last year, anonymous investors have been acquiring enough land to build something the size of Bristol or New Orleans without telling anybody what they were up to.
So quite an intriguing prospect. What's their vision?
The idea comes from a former Goldman Sachs banker, Jan Stramek, who was born in the Czech Republic, was too smart for Cambridge, so left after a year to go to the LSE, where he claimed not to have done much work, but obviously got through with double firsts, then went to Goldman's. And then, as the masters of the universe are wont to, started thinking about how he could disrupt things. He tried a couple of businesses, which didn't make it. And then he found himself in California and met a couple of people with serious amounts of cash and pitched this idea of how do we deal with that problem that so many Western cities have of where do you put people in affordable housing? How do you actually grow in a situation in which everybody understands that there needs to be housing for their kids or for the policemen or the teachers that every community depends on, but they don't want them in their backyard. And we have to remember also that San Francisco, though we have this idea of a beautiful West Coast liberal enclave, has really had a hard couple of decades. It's got a rather disturbing concentration of street sleepers. Property values are out of control. In downtown, we're going back to scenes not seen since the 60s of department stores closing down. So Stramek basically said, let's start again. Let's see what it would be like to build a major-sized city from nowhere. And he was relying on one of those very old mechanisms, the extraordinary variations in land values. In California, in this part of California at the moment, you can buy an acre of farmland for about $5,000. If you can get planning consent to build houses on it, it might be worth $100,000. So the trick is to buy it farmland without anybody knowing what you're up to, and then invest the money you need to get the laws changed. And that's where we are now.
And that's exactly what Stramek and his team, I guess, who are involved, have done over the past few years. How much land have they bought?
It's about 78 square miles, which is huge. And quite how many people you could put on that, it's hard to say. It depends. At London densities, you could probably put 1 million people there. America likes to live in a more spread out way. So They're reckoning that one day it could be 400,000 people. At the moment, the plans have been drawn up in some detail for about 50,000 people, which is still a lot when you think that King Charles III's development at Poundbury after 30 years is only 4,000 people. Or Milton Keynes, which was Britain's last attempt to build something on a large scale, has taken 40 years to reach 200,000 people.
And is there a sense that this city would be a new form of American living, or is it just an additional city, American city, in the mould that we know?
So 7 years of secrecy allowed some quite lurid ideas to kind of permeate through California about what was going on here. Some people thought Disney was planning to build another theme park. The more paranoid Californians thought that it was the Chinese government acquiring the land to spy on the Air Force base. And when the New York Times leaked the fact of who is really behind this project, of course, it was immediately presented as being a cabal of billionaires abandoning the old city and doing a sort of Elon Musk, we've got to go to Mars to survive scenario. There was even an idea that it might be something like Saudi Arabia's NEOM with flying taxis, gigantic skyscrapers, and all that. And the damage control moved quickly from California Forever, as they call this project, to suggest, no, we're actually going back to the past to build the city of the future. The images of that beloved idea of suburban America, but slightly denser, with walkable streets, with neighborhood cafes, walking distance to a shop and a convenience store, those things that European cities take for granted, but which in America are still seen as being exceptional.
So, I mean, that vision doesn't sound completely outlandish in one description, a vision of a city with walkable streets, with community amenities, but not everybody is in favour of this development at all, are they? Can you talk about who opposes it and why?
If you're a farmer and you've sold somebody that you've never met your land at $5,000 an acre, and you get to understand that this person that bought it is a group that includes Steve Jobs' widow, a couple of other masters of the universe like Mark Andreessen, people that made a fortune out of the dot-com boom, and they're going to make the profits from this, you're going to feel fairly disappointed, to put it mildly, that this benevolent private developer will be investing in creating some jobs, will be investing in some infrastructure, but they're not going to connect this place to the mass transit system that San Francisco has. So it might be walkable at the local level, but in terms of sustainability in an area which is already dry, they're already arguing about where the water is going to come from. In some ways, the history of planning in California is encapsulated in two great movies, Chinatown, which was Polanski's look, yes, at corruption, but also about control of water and how that led Californian growth, and Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which was about skullduggery and the buying up of the mass transit system in Los Angeles. And local opponents have accused California Forever of adopting strategies not that dissimilar from either of those.
Is it right to say that those local opposition voices will get to have a say in whether California Forever goes ahead or not?
Absolutely. At the moment, all this is conditional. Ceramics investors have bought a lot of land, but their ability to actually realise the schemes they're talking about depend entirely on the Solano County electorate. There will be on the ballot in November at the time of the presidential election. Once Californians in the area have chosen who they want for president, they'll have a chance to tick the box for yes or no to the idea of this massive change to the local planning system. And at the moment, Sramek and his backers are spending heavily on a major campaign to convince the locals that this is in their best interest.
Do you have a sense of how effective that might be?
The people I've talked to say follow the money, and in America the money tends to win.
Interesting. So, I mean, in this example of California Forever, we've got the billionaire backers, though they slightly object to the idea of California Forever being branded a billionaire city. And you've got the landowners, the locals who might not themselves be in need of affordable housing. Is that right? But don't necessarily want new housing built for those who do need it in their backyards. Is that correct? And is that a picture that's kind of common in America?
California is not the same as Rust Belt America. It's not the same as suburban London. And this is a relatively prosperous part of California. So the people that are actually selling large plots of land to Sramek and his backers will do pretty well financially. The question is what it's going to be like for the wider community. Where are those people going to come from? If it does become a city of 400,000 people, that's a place for policemen, teachers, nurses from who are now excluded from central or downtown San Francisco, a place where they could conceivably find somewhere to live, which actually seems to be a worthwhile and defendable proposition. Some of the incentives that Jan Sramek has offered, like subsidized mortgages for first-time buyers from the area, again seem to be interesting and worthwhile propositions. You could say that all around the world there's a market failure in developed economies to provide decent, affordable housing where people need it. In Britain, it used to be the state that provided much of Europe. Social housing was the means. In the 70s and 80s, the Thatcherite revolution swept all that away, and we've still not found a model to replace what state intervention in housing could offer.
Given that this project is somewhat trying to tackle the limited housing in San Francisco, have the authorities in San Francisco themselves commented on the plan or engaged in it in any way? Is it welcomed by those state institutions that might once have provided the housing that now this billionaire-backed city is hoping to provide?
So a couple of local congressmen, both Democrats, have denounced California Forever as playing hardball, mob-like tactics, intimidation. There have been lawsuits brought against some of the landowners for trying to rig the market by asking for inflated prices. People have had their leases for farming on some of this land, terminated land that the California River has already bought. They've thrown people off the land for criticizing them. They've not been playing nice.
After the break, we'll talk more about new cities and the crisis in affordable housing. But first, I'd like to tell you about the upgraded digital experience you can enjoy with the new Prospect app. Stay informed and engaged with our independent journalism at your fingertips. Read or listen anywhere, at any time. The app not only gives you access to our articles, but also includes audio narration, plus podcasts like the one you're listening to right now. Subscribe to Prospect and get instant access to the new app, available on iOS and Android.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
For Prospect, you've looked at some other new developments around the world. I mean, you mentioned this idea to build this kind of, it's more than a city really, NEOM in Saudi Arabia. Do you think there are parallels between this billionaire city in California forever, and this very futuristic kind of vision of a community in neon.
I think we belong to a generation which became very suspicious of big picture planning. That went with nuclear power stations, motorways being driven through the heart of cities. We've been infected by this idea that new means worse. And regimes from Saudi Arabia to California with the California Forever Project have got tired of that. They're impatient with the difficulties that come from dealing with an existing city. So there's a sense of impatience. At one extreme, it's NEOM, which is an idea for housing 8 million people in a single linear city, 125 kilometres long, with high-rises 500 metres high, which is just to the edge of the possible. The other extreme aesthetically is kind of California Forever, which is low-rise, walkable, 8 stories high, rather more attractive. You could say it's the yin and yang, but they are both versions of the same idea of let's start again.
In design terms, and both, you know, design aesthetically, design in terms of its sort of functionality for human life, do you have a preference for which route is the better one to go down if we're to build new communities? Is it that high-rise vision? Is it that spaced-out, walkable community?
When I first went to Milton Keynes, which used to be a laughing stock known for its concrete cows and its endless roundabouts, I used to say to myself, if someone put a gun to your head and you had to live in a new town, I would definitely choose Milton Keynes, because it was done with a sense of care about what it was like to walk down a street, what your front door might be like, how you might know one area from another. And I do think that sensitive architecture and planning can do things which make places a better place to live. I live in Camden, which is just on the edge of Nash, the great architect of the Regency's creation of Regent's Park, the great terraces around that, land speculation in its day, now seen as priceless heritage. And of those two options of yin and yang, I think that California Forever has a better chance of lasting than a megalithic monostructure that Saudi Arabia is planning to build for reasons best known to itself.
Do you think that a team made of the extremely wealthy can equally well provide housing for, like you say, the teachers, the lower paid workers perhaps in society, than the state?
Our view of state housing is shaped by the 1970s, which saw the dynamiting of buildings that were less than 25 years old, which was seen as a gigantic failure, a sense of what was promised as a utopia of social housing was characterized before it even become a teenager as beyond saving. And quite why we thought that is you know, our views now of those attempts at building a welfare state in the 1960s, our views have changed completely. It's as if, you know, we used to see Victorian architecture as a terrible, at best, joke, in the same way that brutalism was once seen as the sum of all evils and is now the subject of countless Instagram posts. We suddenly fall in love with brutalism, and maybe we fall in love with it not just because we love raw concrete, but that there was a time when architects believed that building schools and hospitals and new universities and affordable housing was a worthwhile end in itself. And we're still carrying that burden of what the Thatcher years gave us, that sense that social housing is somehow bad. And clearly not all social housing is bad. The format, the care with which some of that housing was built is so important. And maybe in the same way that now we have this idea of instant cities or creating cities from scratch, dealing with the problems of the recent past was also overwhelmed by that search for instant solutions. To show that you're doing something, a politician will say, let's knock it down and start again, which is quicker and easier than trying to patch something up. Mm-hmm. But now we're at a time when nothing should be demolished unless there's really good reasons, given the climate emergency.
Could you see a new town being planned and built in the UK, either by the state or by private investors?
Keir Starmer is committed to building a new generation of Labour new towns. We haven't had much detail of what they would be like yet. If they like Milton Keynes, I'm all for it.
Do you think that we need those new towns? Or is there... One thing people talk about is the sort of empty housing stock and the need to potentially repurpose that to house people who are in desperate need of more permanent accommodation. Do we really need those new towns? Or would government money be better spent on refurbishing and renovating to make that housing stock we do have kind of fit for purpose?
Britain now is heading for 70 million people. It's about 68 million. When I was a student, it was about 55 million. And in those days, Britain was building something like 400,000 council houses a year. It's close to 150,000 now. And the private sector is certainly not filling that gap. So that is why house prices go on rising and rising and rising. And the idea of owning a home has become impossible for a generation. Now, I'm not necessarily convinced that home ownership is in itself the be-all and end-all, but people do need somewhere to live, somewhere of a decent size, somewhere that feels like a place rather than an anonymous shoebox. And those new towns might be one way to do that.
Do you think that's the better way to do it?
I don't think there's any one solution to things. The problem with approaches to planning and development in the city is that there are so few good ideas that once somebody has one, then it's kind of spreads virally around the world and people try and replicate it. So there was a time when the Bilbao effect was the only, the way you rescue a rust bucket city with closed down shipyards is to build a exhibitionistic branch of the Guggenheim Museum there, and all good will flow thereafter. It's not that simple. Cities are complex organisms which are not shaped only by architects or by developers or by politicians or by road engineers or by the lawyers that write leases. They're shaped by a complex interplay of all of those things. The problem is that very rarely do those people get in the same room together and think about how they might work together.
And so if we were to have new cities built in the UK to meet that need for housing, you talked about how you bring all of those elements to the complex organism that is a city. How do you make sure that new cities are cities for everybody with all kinds of different jobs, all cultures, all levels of socioeconomic resources, and that it's not just a place that people are sent to in a way if they can't afford to live in the big cities we already have, where there's business and industry and the service sector?
I think a successful city is a city which offers the largest percentage of its people the widest possible choices. And cities which shut down choice, which offer few alternatives, are those that tend not to succeed and the ones that tend not to flourish in the long term. So London is an extraordinarily successful city in many ways. When I want to feel optimistic, I go to Brick Lane, where I can find a building that was originally put up in the 18th century by Huguenot refugees fleeing religious persecution in France. They built a Protestant chapel, they joined the community, they prospered, they moved. That building then became a Methodist chapel. As the community changed, it became a Jewish synagogue. It's now a mosque. And to me, that's what a city does. Its resources can be used and reused over the years. Cities are about choice.
Diane, well, thank you very much for joining us, giving us some insight into this California Forever project that we'll be keeping our eyes on election day. It won't be our top priority, but thank you very much for joining us, Diane. It's been really lovely to speak with you.
It's been fun.
That's all for now. Thanks so much to Diane for joining us, and thanks to our listeners at home for tuning in. If you enjoyed this podcast, then head over to our website at prospectmagazine.co.uk or our app, where you can read Diane's excellent feature, as well as Sheila Hancock and Alice Garnett in an intergenerational conversation, Peter Kellner's analysis of the latest political polls, and much, much more. Goodbye for now, and see you next time.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.